From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. More than 50 nations were expected to attend the opening of the Nuclear Security Summit in Washington Thursday. However, Russia, which has, according to U.S. estimates, at least 8,000 nuclear warheads, will not be among them. CCTV's Daria Bondarchuk filed this report from Moscow.
The Nuclear Security Summit in Washington will bring together world leaders on a mission to reinforce their country's commitments to secure nuclear technologies and materials. Russia has attended three previous summits in Washington, D.C. in 2010, in Seoul in 2012, and in The Hague in 2014. However, at the end of the last summit, Russia said it had already decided it would not participate in the next one. Some countries interpreted that decision as a reaction to increased tensions with the United States. Russian experts say Russia's absence from the security summit does not mean that it intends to turn away from its previous summit commitments. Nor, they say, is it planning to give up its obligations under the United Nations nuclear body, the IAEA, or the Global Initiative to Combat Nuclear Terrorism. But Moscow maintains that while previous summits were useful in forging an international consensus on nuclear security and raising awareness of the nuclear terrorism threat, they've now run their course.
After these questions were successfully discussed in an informal way, and after a number of commitments were made unilaterally and voluntarily, it's time for these questions to be transferred to long-existing mechanisms, such as the Global Initiative to Combat Nuclear Terrorism, if we speak about nuclear terrorism, and the IAEA, if the talk is about physical security of nuclear materials.
Russia says the Nuclear Security Summit, however well-intentioned, has become a source of interference for large international bodies whose work should be paramount, most importantly the IAEA, and for that reason Moscow says it can no longer be part. Daria Bondarchuk, CCTV, Moscow.
Meanwhile, Russia's envoy to NATO, Alexander Grishko, said Wednesday that Moscow would not sit passively and watch the U.S. and NATO military build up in Europe, saying his country would provide an asymmetrical response. He said Russia's response will be highly efficient, not overly expensive, and calibrated in accordance with Russia's understanding of the military threat it faces. Those comments came in response to a recent Pentagon announcement that the U.S. was readying a more robust military presence in Eastern Europe. On Wednesday, the Pentagon revealed plans to position American troops, tanks, and other armored vehicles full-time along NATO's eastern borders to deter what it called Russian aggression, the first such deployment since the end of the Cold War. Much of those assets would be placed along Russia's borders. According to a report in the Wall Street Journal, the new gear includes 250 tanks, Bradley fighting vehicles, and Palladian self-propelled howitzers, as well as more than 1,700 additional wheeled vehicles and trucks. The White House approved the broad contours of the plan, designated to start in February of next year, when it signed off on the $3.4 billion European Reassurance Initiative budget last month, leaving the specifics to the Pentagon. Congress still has to approve the request. 7 out of 10 people in the world today live in countries where income inequality has risen, in many cases, to the highest level in 3 decades. That, according to Oh Jun, the president of the UN Economic and Social Council, ECOSOC, during a special meeting on inequality Wednesday. He said the trend needs to be reversed if the UN global goals for 2030, which promised to, quote, reduce inequality and leave no one behind, close quote, were to be realized. Jocelyn Sambira reports.
More than half of the total wealth of the world is owned by the top earners, known as the 1%, said the ECOSOC president, Oh Jun. Gaps in income and wealth have consistently widened around the world, even though poverty rates have generally declined in every region of the world, he noted. These disparities have been made worse because of the unequal access to basic human needs like food, water, and health care. Here's Mr. Jun.
Around the world, women in rural areas remain 3 times more likely to die in childbirth than those in urban areas. And children born in poorer households are less likely to complete their primary education. When we see all of this, we realize that something may be seriously wrong, that if such trends continue, our communities will have to suffer social and political instability, often providing a breeding ground for extremism.
4 million people lack basic health care services around the world, according to UN figures. Jocelyn Sambira, United Nations.
Today we continue our coverage of the U.S. presidential election by speaking with Margaret Kimberly, New York-based activist and writer who authors a weekly column called Freedom Rider at blackagendareport.com. Her column this week is entitled, Hillary Clinton is No Worse Than Barack Obama. We spoke with her via telephone from New York Thursday.
I wrote it because a lot of Sanders supporters, and let me just say, people have a right to support Bernie Sanders. I'm not attacking people because of that. But I have noticed that in supporting Sanders, everyone makes Hillary Clinton out to be so evil, which I actually can't argue against. The facts are there. But I notice that no one attacks Obama in the same way. At a Black Agenda Report back in 2008, when she and Obama were running for the nomination, Glenn Ford coined the term political twins. He said they are, in fact, the same. The only difference between them is that Obama is smarter and smoother and doesn't, you know, cackle about killing Muammar Gaddafi. He still killed him, but he has the good sense not to be so obvious about it. She's very obvious with her evil. And we also say there's no lesser evil in politics. There's just effective evil and ineffective evil. And Obama exemplifies effective evilness. So, but Hillary does not. So it's easy for people to point to those things, to point to her, the speeches to Goldman Sachs and other Wall Street firms, and her obvious ties to the corporate world, her obvious imperialism. And so people attack these things, and I'm not saying they shouldn't, in supporting Sanders, but everybody leaves out Obama. So if you're going to criticize her for killing Gaddafi, you should be attacking Obama as well. Now he's leaving office. That's part of the reason. But she is part of a larger problem within the Democratic Party. And one of the things that troubles me about this, and it's, you know, this idol worship that some people have for Sanders, is that if you're not going to repudiate the Democratic Party, there's no point in acting as if supporting this particular person is going to bring about any change. People are very personality driven, even I'd say especially progressives, because they don't really have any true political ideology. So every 4 years they look for the Democrat that they like the most. So, and they have policy reasons for doing that, but it just turns into this love fest. There's this, and I don't think people even know what it means to be really politically active and the importance of movement politics as opposed to electoral politics, and just hoping if I vote for this person instead of this person, then all's going to be right with the world. It still won't be right because the Democratic Party needs to go. We must dump the Democrats. I think anybody who calls him or herself a leftist can no longer support the Democrats.
You know, before we get into the relationship of the election to movement politics and the potential that the apparent collapse of the Republican Party and the quite possible collapse of the Democratic Party presents, I want to work this a little more for people. Mm-hmm. The other day I was reading yet another argument about the United Front, or the cartoon United Front that people are calling for against Trump, many of them holding Hillary Clinton out as a modern Hindenburg. And, and you have to remind people what Hindenburg did after he was elected to save Germany from Hitler. He made him chancellor. and signed the basic law that surrendered the government to the Nazi Party. He did that too. Yeah. But here we have a situation where Barack Obama's foreign policy as enunciated in 2008 and Hillary Clinton's record on the foreign policy in 2008, and Obama didn't have much of one and it wasn't given much scrutiny, you know, the differences between them were blown into huge proportion. Not that he called the Iraq war stupid and he wouldn't do stupid wars. Mm-hmm. People ignored more or less what he was saying about expanding the war in Afghanistan for as much sense as that made. And then again, the first thing that he does is put his foreign policy in the hands of Hillary Clinton after he's elected.
Yes. Well, it just shows you the falseness of this notion that there's some big difference between them. A couple things about Obama. He got credit. She voted in favor of the Iraq war, so she had to live with that. He wasn't in the Senate yet, but there's an ignored statement that he made to a New York Times reporter. He was asked, how would you have voted had you been in the Senate? And he said, I don't know. And this is one of those things that just disappeared, and that tells you he was the corporate favorite, that they disappear anything that might have been held against him.
And he voted for appropriations while he was in the Senate.
That's true, he did. And, you know, our men and women are fighting, we can't leave them, blah, blah, blah. So he supported without supporting, and I'm not going to support dumb wars. Basically, for him, that means not sending U.S. troops.
Right.
So he fights wars, he intervenes in other countries, he lets other people invade Syria, for example. So the Saudis and the Turks and the other Gulf monarchs pay these jihadist groups to terrorize Syria, so without sending American troops, he tried to overthrow the Assad government. So that's what he means by a dumb war, not having American fingerprints so directly involved. So that's what he does. And of course, there was deal making when he and Hillary Clinton fought to an almost draw, and neither had enough delegates to get the nomination outright. Mm-hmm. He had to make a deal with her,
right,
and ask her what she wanted. And he said yes to her being Secretary of State. But I remind people all the time, he was her boss. So any foreign policy she carried out with his permission.
That's right. She's the agent. He's the principal. Agent and principal, yep. Okay, so we're looking at a condition where the Republican Party may end up with Trump as their candidate, or Cruz, and in either case, that party's seriously injured. But with Trump as their candidate, he's made some extremely unusual, historically, statements about foreign policy that are unusual going back to, like, 1946.
Yeah.
And Sanders has been tepid at best. He's been focusing on domestic economic issues. He has a long record in the Senate and the House, and some of that includes some very strong support for some of the wars.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering now, Sanders, of course, his defenders will say, can't take a left position on foreign policy while he's a declared socialist. That would be political suicide, but we'll see his policies later, which is what we heard about Obama to an extent.
Yes.
And I'm wondering, though, the statistics, there was a survey last week, early March, it was in Wall Street Journal and NBC. One-third of Sanders supporters said that they see themselves voting for Clinton under no conditions. And if you end up with a brokered convention and more of them are angered over that, you could see even more of that as a setting for the election. Sanders says, in turn, I'm going to set some conditions for support of Clinton if she wins the nomination. And he's doing this pontificating instead of looking to his grassroots for that. I'm wondering, with the space that Trump is opening up in a discussion of foreign policy, and with an active base under Sanders forcing him to take more progressive positions on foreign policy, is it possible that they could do that?
Well, you know, it's the funny thing about Trump. Trump is interesting because he has something for everyone. He says something that can appeal to just about every political constituency in the country.
Sure.
So on the one hand is, you know, let's build the wall, keep out the immigrants, keep out Muslims. He can appeal to the racists. He can talk about cutting the budget that appeals to fiscal conservatives. He can say we should not have overthrown Saddam Hussein or Muammar Gaddafi, and that appeals to some leftists. But he's, you know, he also acts as if he treats everything like he's a real estate deal, because that's, after all, what he's done his whole life. So he's like, I can do a deal with Putin. Well, what does that mean, doing a deal with Putin? It's, he's not, you know, Putin's not a real estate developer. It's, you know, I guess he means diplomacy, but you never know with Trump. And it's good to hear someone say that Russia should not be America's enemy. That's a positive development, but I don't have confidence in Trump being in charge of foreign policy.
Me neither.
Either. So, but, you know, I have never heard a politician say he would be neutral or even-handed. I can't remember the term he used about Israel. Never, ever. Not a Democrat, not a Republican, no one who is running for high office. So that is a positive development, and Trump's supporters don't care about foreign policy, and Trump is exposing the degree to which Republican elites don't represent their rank and file. People have, you know, the Republicans have become the de facto, as we say at Black Agenda Report, the white people's party. Right. And so they get a lot of support just for that reason. But when Republican voters had the opportunity to vote for someone who offered somebody else, they've taken it. And it's going to be interesting to see. I don't know how you deny somebody the nomination if he gets most of the delegates. It could be the end of the Republican Party. I hope we see an end to both parties, frankly. Yeah. But so that's the situation we're in. I don't know that. It's hard to say what people will really do when they're in the voting booth. You know, there are people who say, I'll vote for Trump instead of voting for Hillary. Will they really? I don't know. I think there's more likely to be low turnout, Sanders supporters not showing up on election day. I tend to think that's going to happen more likely than it is that they're going to vote for Donald Trump. But everything's very fluid this year. This is a year where I don't feel comfortable making any predictions, to be honest. And, you know, now Trump has said that he started out saying he would support the eventual nominee if it were not him. Now he's saying he's not going to do that. So he may run as a third-party candidate. That changes things. If he does that, if there's a Republican and Trump, then the Democratic nominee will win, I'm pretty sure.
And then suppose that scenario is playing out while, through machinations, perhaps a brokered convention, Hillary Clinton ends up as the Democratic candidate. And mm-hmm. some portion of the Sanders supporters walk out, as they promise.
Mm-hmm. Well, that doesn't keep her from being the nominee. The delegate count is, it's hard to say what it really is. Is it the superdelegates, these elected officials who are automatically delegates? Is it, based on the number of votes each has received? She may honestly get the nomination. She may properly get enough delegates to win. But Sanders people are so fired up and are so, you know, willing to blame her for anything. They may end up walking out anyhow, but that doesn't mean, depending on what happens on the Republican side, it doesn't mean that she cannot win. But it's interesting, in Arizona a couple of weeks ago, and this is, the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act, and Arizona was one among those states that had to seek federal permission before making any voting changes. Well, the state of Arizona eliminated 70% of their polling places. And people literally could not vote. They had to wait online 5 hours, 6 hours to vote. Some weren't able to vote. People had changed their party affiliation and it didn't show up. And Sanders, people say it's all Hillary Clinton. Now, Arizona's a red state. I don't think Hillary Clinton or any Democrat has any sway in enacting voting rules in Arizona. But that's now the cartoonish level of what passes for political discourse, is that Hillary is evil and Bernie is good. So, and this is why I am unimpressed with the Sanders people. One of the reasons I'm unimpressed with the Sanders people. So I don't know what all this means for them to say they'll walk out of the convention. I don't think that necessarily is going to matter. What really matters, and if people want change or revolution, and I'm not even sure what the word revolution means to liberals, we have to stop the emphasis on electoral politics altogether. We've achieved a lot in this country in means other than elections. In the 60s, everyone talks about the civil rights struggle, the black liberation movement. In the 60s, most black people couldn't even vote. Most still lived in the South and couldn't vote at all, and yet saw great progress. So I think we need to talk about that instead of getting sucked into this, you know, vortex of electoral politics, which ends up being a huge distraction from people who really want to see fundamental change in this country.
So let's assume that that scenario plays out and Sanders people not just walk out of the convention, but sit on their hands in November or go shopping for alternatives, mm-hmm. looking at the Greens or the Workers' World candidate, whomever. And some may actually vote for Trump. What is that? Like, the political landscape looks much different in terms of electoral politics, but you also have this anger that's seething more or less through the electorate and, you know, just through the former workplace, people that are underemployed, unemployed, all of the problems people are facing now. How do you get something going in terms of mobilizing people and building some unity among working class people, particularly where you can see the two camps behind Trump and Sanders at each other's throats in a way? What do you do to try to develop some sort of a positive outcome out of this chaos?
Well, I think a positive outcome would be if people said they were still going to vote, but they were going to vote for another party. I think the first thing we have to do, I don't think there's any improving the Democrats. People have to stop supporting them. So if people vote Green or vote for some other party, that is, to my mind, a positive development altogether. You know, people have said, Angela Davis said, we need a third party. Other people have said, we need a third party. Well, we have third parties now. I don't know what people are waiting for. They're waiting for somebody to bestow a party on them. You build a party by building a party. And by rejecting, in this case, the Democrats. So if Sanders people vote for another party, I think that's all to the good, and I would take them more seriously, frankly. But mobilizing, I think somebody has to say that we have to start mobilizing, that trying to build a better Democratic Party is a failure. It just cannot work because it is what it is. It's a corporate party. It's an imperialist party. And there's no reforming it, no changing it, no improving it. So we have to start from scratch. Stop voting for them. I think that's the first thing. And that's terrifying for people who don't, who haven't been taught there's anything else to do. Nader was blamed for Gore's defeat. So that trauma still exists 16 years later. But that would be a positive step if the Sanders people really acted like political actors and voted for another party. That would be a great start.
And so also, you know, you invoked the Nader example. With a fractured Republican Party, it would be a hell of a lot harder to sell that watch out for the Republicans, you have to vote for the Democrat argument.
But the other thing I wanted to, I'm sorry, backtrack a little bit, that happened with Nader. It is true that you're turned into a spoiler the way our system is set up, but I think people have to also realize the importance of being activists and being movement-driven in order to change things, and that's the thing that's missing. But I think if we have that, whoever the nominees are, I think that's when we'll see this, you know, revolution or whatever it is. People, I don't know that most people in this country are really serious when they talk about that. But so I think that's the issue too with voting for a party other than the Democrats. It has to go. It can't just be voting.
To me, I mean, back in 2000, and 2001, when people started slinging that at Nader, to me, it seemed like what he should have done was claimed it. So, yeah, that's right. I took it from you, and I'm going to take it from you again until you guys turn around.
That's true. Well, you know, I sort of think Nader thought Gore was going to win.
Yeah, maybe, huh?
I think that's why he didn't. So, you know, nobody foresaw the vote theft in Florida, which was achieved by keeping people off the polls. Thousands of people who were likely Democratic voters were unjustly kept from voting. That is how Gore lost Florida. So I think when we talk about that, we should always mention it. But I think you're right. There are very few people who are really serious about wanting change, about shaking up the system. And I think that trauma of Bush losing the election but becoming president, but that's what happens when you keep talking about elections over and over again and not about anything else. So no one was ready for that, including Ralph Nader.
In New York City's borough of Brooklyn, it appears that black lives only matter to the extent of 5 years probation. Black Agenda Reports' Glenn Ford has more.
Last week, the district attorney for Brooklyn, New York, recommended that the cop who was convicted in the death of Akai Gurley not spend a single day in prison, but instead serve 5 years probation, 6 months on home confinement, and do 500 hours of community service. The cop's lawyer called the DA's decision courageous. Members of the city's Chinese American community had packed the trial, demanding that former officer Peter Liang be acquitted of negligent manslaughter charges for shooting Gurley as the unarmed 28-year-old father walked in the darkened stairwell of a public housing apartment building with his girlfriend. Liang's supporters argued that he would not have faced charges at all if he had been white. Akai Gurley's family was outraged. They said District Attorney Thompson's recommendation sends the message that police officers who kill people should not face serious consequences. At least some of the jurors that convicted the cop agreed. One asked, "What was the point of prosecuting him? If something is wrong, you shouldn't get a slap on the wrist." Another juror said the DA's call for leniency was ridiculous and confided to the Daily News that his own father had spent 7 years in prison for accidentally shooting a friend. However, the only black on the jury, a 69-year-old man, said the prosecutor was only doing his job. The person who will have the final say in the case is Brooklyn Supreme Court Justice Danny Chun, who's scheduled to sentence Liang on April 14th. Before he was appointed to the court, Chun, a Korean-American, was a prosecutor. The Brooklyn DA's decision means that even when a police officer is convicted of criminally negligent homicide in the death of an unarmed and totally non-threatening black man, in a trial in which the chief prosecutor is black, the chances of meaningful punishment are slim because impunity for police is built into the system. No matter the weight of the evidence, black lives don't really matter in the U.S. criminal justice system. So inconsequential was the life of Akai Gurley that Chinese Americans believed that Officer Liang was entitled to the same impunity, the same free pass in the death of a black man as a white cop would expect to get. Ken Thompson, the black prosecutor, clearly feels the same way. He is a career Democratic politician whose allegiance is to the party and the system that appointed him, not to black people, and certainly not to any notions of justice. His job, as he saw it, was to prevent the jury from dispensing justice, to turn loose a killer cop, because he is a killer prosecutor. And, as Akai Gurley's supporters said throughout the trial, the whole damn system is guilty as hell. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.